Well, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to today's occasional lecture. We're continuing our fabulous 2011 series with another perspective on public affairs today. Being Senate chauvinists, we don't often give the executive the nod, but today I'm very pleased to be able to say that we're changing that just for today. And there's no better person to talk to us about these things than Professor Patrick Weller AO, who's a very distinguished academic and has written very widely in this field for many years. He's currently the Premier of Queensland Chair of Public Management and the Director of the Centre for Governance and Public Policy at Griffith University. So please welcome Professor Patrick Weller to talk about learning to be a minister.
Thank you for that introduction. We, at least in theory, attribute some heroic attributes to our ministers. As soon as they've been elected, we expect them to take on extensive responsibilities as though they've been there for years. We expect them to answer for the actions of their departments. We expect them to answer questions to the media. We expect them to oversee policy initiatives, even if they've been sworn into a department about which they knew almost nothing. So, the press expect administrative competence, subject omniscience, and media understanding and media savvy, all within the first week. Of course, we actually know it's not like that at all. We actually know that for many new ministers, the first few months are a sort of combination of a graduate seminar in the topic and an exercise in defusing the minds that have been left there by the predecessor. So it's an exercise in how do I manage in those first few weeks. Some make it. Others are still struggling some months further on. And very few are given any slack by the media, or, of course, by the opposition, who not only created many of the problems, but initially at least know a lot better than the ministers what the departments have actually been doing. So when there was a change of government 3 years ago, a couple of us decided to find out how ministers learnt to do the jobs, how they understood their first months in the role, what the lessons were. So we talked to a large percentage of the new Labour ministers and a number of the previous coalition ministers and asked them to look back on the time, if they could, when they were actually finding it all very new. And there was a second intention as well. Some 30 years ago, Michelle Grattan of The Age and I wrote a book called Can Ministers Cope? We left the title indecisive because having finished the book, we weren't sure. But we not only wanted to ask those questions about what they were doing in the 1970s, because the book was actually published in 1981, we not only wanted to understand what they did, but we wanted to understand what had changed. To what extent were ministers now under greater pressure than they had been in the past? So what I want to share today is some of the impressions of those ministers and the particular challenges which they had. Because Labour had comparatively few ministers with actual past experience in the ministry. They actually had to learn the job from the very beginning. And one of them said this to us. There are courses for almost every occupation, but there's no course that teaches you how to be a member of parliament. There's no course that teaches you how to be a minister. It's assumed that if you're elected, you can be sworn in and you can be an effective minister. And unless you ask, no one volunteers to help. So basically you do it from gleaning what you can watch from others and applying what you think are common sense principles to the sorts of things you're called upon to do. So you walk in and day one, suddenly you're a minister, and of course you know how to be a minister. Compare that to the United States, for instance. There's an election in November and the president isn't sworn in until the end of January. And compare the choices in those 2.5 months that the president of the United States has. He wants a cabinet, he's got a population of 250 million. An incoming government in Australia wants 30 ministers, it has a population of somewhere around 100 from which it can choose. 100 to fill 30 positions. it's inevitable there's going to be some sort of unevenness which occurs, and that some are going to be more successful than others. But the interesting thing is you often can't tell. It's difficult to tell from past performance necessarily who will be the good minister. One can tell stories about hedge funds in the United States which went bankrupt despite having three economics Nobel Prize winners. Academic skill doesn't necessarily make it. Past experience doesn't necessarily make it. There's a sort of gut feeling about who is going to be successful. So we wanted to ask people what it felt like. Well, one had a very quick lesson in how departments work in the public service. He said, I was sworn in and then came back to the office. And this guy in overalls was taking out the fridge. I'd taken over a coalition minister's ministerial office. And I said, what are you doing with my fridge? He said, Minister, this is the property of the department or something else. I'm taking it to the minister's office. I said, oh, what am I meant to do for a fridge? He said, I suggest you call your department. And that was his introduction to government. Even in Parliament House, fridges belong to departments. But some of them found rather pleasant experiences, particularly when they had come from opposition. Some used to say to us, every day I get up in government, I realise how much worse opposition is, much worse than I expected. But one suddenly found, again, how constructively interesting and useful the public service could be. He said, the funniest thing was I had laid out in opposition some policies, some amendments, and my predecessor would say regularly, well, what the shadow minister's proposing is completely unworkable. The department's advice is it can't be done. If it were done, it would create all these problems which just show that the shadow minister isn't fit to hold office. He's completely out of touch with reality. He said, and I'm sitting there thinking, well, I thought it was a good idea. So I thought when I walked into that meeting, well, there were all these people who were briefed that everything I wanted to do was completely unworkable and that couldn't be done, so this is going to be an interesting meeting. So I sat down and after the introductions I said, I do have some proposals and ideas of what I'd like to do. And the secretary said, oh, yes, Minister. We kept track of your comments and your amendments and your policies, and he pulled out a folder and he said, here's the implementation plan. I thought, well, this beats opposition any day. So, yeah, I found the public service very professional. And it's that fascinating learning exercise that suddenly there are a group of people out there to help you, and I'll talk a bit more about the role of the public service. And this is for somebody, of course, who's never been in government, but has been in opposition. And for the opposition, the exercise is, can we get into the media? Can we get any attention at all? What we're about is getting someone to talk to us and listen to what it is that we're doing. When you're in government, you suddenly find that instead of life being 90% media and 10% policy, it's 90% policy and 10% media. So they say it's a completely different learning curve. And Tony Blair, looking back on his time in government, used to say it took us 2 years to learn that we still weren't in opposition. It took us 2 years to learn we had to have a different style of working. One of the things they learnt very fast was to be incredibly careful about what they said. In the opposition, if you make a faux pas, you get a little bit of attention and everything goes away. In government, saying something out of order is infinitely more damaging. So, again, listening to a minister. Most of what you do, you can't talk about, particularly in a fraught environment. You do have to be very careful about what you say, about every word you say. And in some ways, that was the hardest part of the job in the first few months. Just being very careful what you said about sensitive issues. It can be interpreted in a whole variety of environments. You can't just have a casual conversation necessarily with people you know, because it may be repeated. So ministers have to suddenly say, well, even when I think I'm off duty, I'm on duty. And of course, these days, with mobile phones acting as cameras and recorders, things that you used to be able to say in private, you can't ever say in private again. And there was a consciousness of that. The other consciousness was turning up at overseas meetings and thinking, well, I'm used to meetings. That's no problem. And then you think, but I'm not used to meetings where the person over there is behind a label that says the United States and the person over there is Japan and I've got an Australia label in front of me. and they sort of take a deep breath and say, we can do this. But there's a challenge there when people suddenly realize what different positions they're in. Well, somebody said they realized they got to a minister when they had to sign a check, which was some many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars. And noted with interest at the end of it, they still put .00 at the end of it for cents. I thought, I'm signing this check for this much money. Life's different. There's a sort of a moment when people suddenly realize that government is so very different. They also realize the workload becomes horrendous. And people say, I used to think in government we could drop round and have a drink with our colleagues, but suddenly we realize we can't. We don't have time. And John Faulkner, after he'd been in defense for a year, looked back at some of the figures which were in defense, which gives some idea of the pressure of the workload. The department had a budget of more than $25 billion per month, civilian staff of nearly 15,000, not including the DMO of 7,500, and uniformed personnel of more than 55,000. The ministers and parliamentary secretaries received 8,944 pieces of correspondence, asked for 1,886 pieces of advice from the department, received 3,959 briefs for action, and 3,041 briefs for advice, 112 cabinet briefs, 304,500 ministerial representations. And we're going to take 30 submissions to the National Security Committee. Now, some of those are 10-second items. But there's an awful lot of items there at 10-second items a time. When you turn up in the morning and each day you are dealing with something like 100 briefs from someone or other. And there's this sudden realization that the system can drive you, the system can keep you extraordinarily busy at the same time. And you have to be a little bit careful. There's another rather nice story that a shadow minister said that when I was a shadow minister, I used to walk in and say, one, two, three, to the two or three or four people working for me, today we need to do one, two, three, four, five. And at the end of a good day, only one would have been done because of a lack of resources. When I became a minister, I'd come in and say, oh, I want one, two, three, four, and five. And a week later, someone would come back and said, well, minister, we've done it. And I said, why have you done that? And they said, because you asked us to. And I said, I did? I've no independent recollection of it at all. So the danger of being a minister is when you say, we're doing this or I want that, that people actually do it. And it's an interesting comment again on how different life is when you get into those sorts of circumstances. I think on the other side, departments genuinely want to be responsive to ministers. But they, of course, have their own agendas. They have the things that need to be done regardless of who the government is at any particular time. And as some ministers realized after a bit, if they sat back and did nothing, they could be incredibly busy. If they didn't initiate anything, there would be an agenda that the department wants to run and wants to run on a continuing basis. It would generate a lot of work and a whole range of activities. And somebody says, a minister said, the department's got its own interests, its own agendas, and they'll want you to sign up to a whole lot of stuff. So you could very easily, as a minister, become totally submerged in important but ultimately insignificant activity. It keeps you busy, it keeps a whole lot of other people busy, but in the end, it doesn't make any difference to the world, and I hate that. I accept that amount of it's unavoidable, the ceremonial part, but I realize that if I want to do it, it has to be me that wants to do it to make any sort of change. Now, when we published in 1981 our book on Can Ministers Cope, there was another significant event that happened the same month. It was the first episode of Yes Minister. So Yes Minister began its run on television as we were trying to promote our book on Can Ministers Cope. And inevitably, we got compared to the program, to our disadvantage. As commentator said, the show at least was brilliant. And they were right, and it's much more fun, and I use it for teaching purposes. Who can compete with that brilliance? But it's been brilliant, and yet in an odd sense, while it kept everyone laughing, it also has had a political effect. It's had a political effect in taking a caricature and suggesting that this is the common reality. And therefore, ministers often approach, I suspect, when a new government approaches the public service with rather more suspicion than they did in the past. And that's not an Australian characteristic. I mean, the joke goes that when Malcolm Fraser and Jeff Yeend, when Malcolm was in hospital and Jeff Yeend visited him, they both watched the programme and both found it uproariously funny, but they laughed in different places. I was once talking to the Cabinet Secretary of Namibia, newly independent parliamentary system in South Africa. And the Prime Minister, he said, the Prime Minister came to me and said, I've just watched the programme, yes, Prime Minister. He said, yes. He said, you wouldn't do that to me, would you? He said, oh, no, Prime Minister. So if it affects Namibia, it affects everyone else. And I think that's actually had a somewhat corrosive effect on some of the initial relations, at least, between governments and their secretaries and their departments, as people have explored the sorts of things that are happening and wondered whether it's going to happen. An experienced minister said to me, some ministers under Howard and some of these ministers, I suspect, under Rudd, regard their department, or their staff regard their department, I'll come back to that, as the enemy. And that's a massive waste of resources. And this, of course, is paranoia. I can't be seen as captive of my department, see, yes, minister. Well, you should never be captive of your department. You should never be a cipher, but to regard them with mistrust is equally as bad. And there has to be some sort of balancing act. The best is when, of course, the two combine. And there's a story about Paul Keating and his department that I actually like. That Keating was going to have to persuade his caucus about some particular things that he wanted to do. So his secretary said he understood intuitively what had to be done. And he said, I have to convince caucus, so give me a brief on that. And I did. And he sent it back and said, this isn't believable. This is what I don't like about it. So I did it again. And he sent it back again. And I did it a third time. And he called me to his office and said, good, you've got it. This is what we wanted. And then he invited me to go with him to caucus. When we got there, I discovered he was speaking from handwritten notes. After my three pieces, he had written his own from that. And then I just sat there and marveled at his presentation about how he got on top of the issues. I should point out that when it comes to briefing, it's a slightly different story from the Kissinger briefing story, in which Kissinger says to a young graduate, I want you to brief me on that, so he spends a week writing a very detailed brief, and gives it to Kissinger, he's called in, Kissinger looks and says, is this really the best you can do? Can't you do better than that? And Kissinger, the person shakes and said, well, go away and do it again properly. He comes back a second time with the brief and hands it to Kissinger and gets called up 24 hours later. Kissinger looks at him and says, is that really the best you can do? Are you sure it's the best? I'll try again. So he brings it up a third time. And Kissinger says, is that absolutely the best you can do? He said, yes, Mr. Kissinger. He said, okay, in that case, this time I'll read it. I think the other thing which is really very interesting is the degree to which, contrary to the views of almost everyone outside Canberra, Parliament really looms very large. That it's not, as most people think, something to be taken for granted, but something which ministers are actually very nervous about, and this goes comfortably across both sides of Parliament. As somebody says to us, when Parliament sits, Parliament is our focus. It's the executive reporting to Parliament. You can get some work done when it's sitting, and sometimes you can't get any work done. I work on the basis, generally, of a parliamentary week. If you survive question time, you've done well. If you've got anything else done, it's a bonus. So if you survive question time, that's useful. A coalition minister said it takes you 6 months before you're comfortable in Parliament. You're terrified when you go to question time because you're terrified because you might not know the issues, but you'll get more and more on top of the issues so you can become more confident. Or I used to take reading into question time in opposition if I knew I wasn't going to ask a question. It was a good chance to read letters. I wouldn't dream of doing that now because you never know where something's actually going to come from. The Howard Minister said, parliamentary days as the minister are really stressful. Even if nothing ostensibly happens, they're quite stressful. You're always on tenterhooks. In fact, I would always be working very hard after question time, but I'd be much more relaxed because normally no crises occur after question time. You've got the rest of the day to yourself. And indeed, I think some of the ministers in the Rudd government initially thought it was a good thing, or probably still do, to have cabinet on Thursday because you'd survive the parliamentary week rather than you have it on Monday when you had to look at the parliamentary week. Senate ministers, of course, think they have their own particular problems getting across a multiplicity of portfolios and argue that really question time in the Senate is much worse than in the House because they actually have to occasionally answer the questions, and also because they're likely to get more. And therefore, it's not their own portfolio which they find challenging. It's the other people's portfolio that they find challenging, which they have to get across on those. And they say the Australian Constitution balances it out. Members of the House of Reps have constituencies. We have the responsibilities across the Chamber and Senate Estimates Committees to balance it out. So there's a learning curve in Parliament, however long you've been there, when you're on the front bench for the first time trying to appreciate what it is that's being done. And the secretaries of departments, too, have a learning curve. To start with, they actually don't know who they might be serving. One secretary expected the shadow spokesman to be appointed and to be confirmed as minister. And the secretary got a call from a chief of staff who he had never heard of. And he said, can you come and see the minister? So he said, oh, which minister? He said, oh, haven't you heard? So he was told who his new minister was, went across to Parliament House, had a three-hour chat with the incoming ministers, talked about the platform commitments, and took with him a lease that needed signing, because there are some things that only the minister can do, and you're conscious that you have to get it done all the time. Life goes on. There'll always be a minister of some sort or other in all the portfolios. Secretaries are quite conscious of that. Now, while all secretaries, of course, thought their ministers were superb, they could all remember previous ones who were not. I once, when I was writing a book on Malcolm Fraser, talked to all Fraser's ministers and sort of said that what they all said was lots of ministers, I wasn't scared of Malcolm, but lots of my ministerial colleagues were. Now, when you've talked to them all, there's something slightly illogical about this. And one said to me, no, I wasn't scared of him at all. And as I left, he rushed after me and said, you're not going to tell him what I said, are you? So secretaries talk about what they want in good ministers. And it's actually quite interesting because of what they talk about and in some respects what they don't talk about. Let me give a series of sort of summaries from them. They like openness, intellectual honesty, an understanding of the boundaries, personal integrity. They want good judgments on what matters and what doesn't, of understanding the machinery of government, what departments can do and can't do. An ideal minister is hard-working, respectful, prepared to engage formally and informally with the department, and one of the few people who said it, was a good politician in the sense that they can influence and work with others. Good ministers have a framework. They trust senior people. But what they really wanted was decisiveness, and what they often didn't talk about was that capacity to deliver, because they're all conscious there are some things that only ministers can do and they as secretaries cannot do. And what somebody said is the best ministers, the ones who make up their mind, focused on policy, know how to work with their colleagues, know how to work with their department, know how to get the legislation happening, know how to work with industry, and know how to make it happen. You get the top 15 ministers federally that are, by and large, seriously good. You get the top 5 in state governments. Although occasionally when I look at state governments, I have trouble coming to 5. So they have high expectations of what they want of their ministers and don't necessarily get everything that they want to achieve. They also give me a list of the things they think are really bad about ministers. These are the bad ones. The ones who want to micromanage and deal in details when they've got no idea about the department or try and start managing when they've got no competence. I don't like the ones who are being chief operating officers, who try and micromanage, become very risk-averse. And this is my experience. They won't make decisions and they go through things umpteen times and it drives you crazy. Or I think the hardest to work with are the ones who are not really committed to their government's agenda, who feel politically exposed about making any difficult decisions. They're too scared to make a decision. What starts off as a good program, by the time it's gone through the policy process, becomes a weak program, but it's nevertheless what the government decides on, and then the ministers don't back you when you do things about it. That notion of the difficulty of getting support from the ministers when you actually need it. And again, what we find is that ministers are right across the spectrum in what they do. What's changed in 30 years? Give me a quick list. Technology, the speed of activity, media coverage, and both cause and effect, a massive increase in ministerial staff. Lindsay Tanner's recent book talks about the media coverage and how it cheapens political activity, and the often self-congratulatory declarations of innocence by some journalists in responding to his book suggest that he had a point. But let me talk about a minister talking about the media long before Lindsay Tanner wrote. The speed of the media and the nature of where the media's gone has created a whole new level of pressure. I'm actually making a democracy point here. They decide whether we will crumble or not. But a diminution of the amount of time devoted to news discussions and the move to infotainment means it necessarily impacts on how our politicians think and behave. I actually think there are real issues for our democracy with the way we seek to distill things into such simplistic concepts. And it's not a they should be smarter comment, it's actually a comment about political dialogue. The problem is they're always difficult problems, and if we keep constructing our national political dialogue around simple solutions, that's going to be dangerous. And another person neatly encapsulated the sorts of problems. The least helpful part is the inability to show uncertainty or consideration. The fact that none of the decision-making process is public is because the idea that decisions aren't fully formed like Venus means there's uncertainty. And if there's uncertainty, there's doubt. And if there's doubt, there's the potential for failure. And so it goes on. And that's a shame because most big decisions are made on balance. This might be the right way to go, or that might be the right way to go. With all the information I've got, I think on balance I'll go with this one. But the way we're expected to present in public and in the media is that this is the only possible answer. Now, I understand, they went on, why as an institution, Parliament and the Ministry had developed that way. But I think it's absolutely, I think in a more mature democracy would take people into its confidence. But I don't think the media culture enables that. I would think it's irresistible to journalists to make it more of that than actually happens. Now, the media space has to be filled every day. So not to respond to the media, leave that space to the opposition and encourages criticism. Ministers argue it's no longer possible just not to comment. Nor is it viable to have ministers providing different responses to the same problem. If that happens, it's the difference, not the response, that becomes the story. So a coordination of responses considered desirable to prevent a consistent policy becomes called spin, when a lack of coordination denotes an uncertain government. Ministers feel they can't win, but of course they will always try. One said, if I wore a red tie, the media would say I should wear a blue tie. If I wore a blue tie, they should say I should wear a red tie, so why should I care? But of course, the other point about the media is they're on call all the time, whether they're in the country or not. Billy Hughes, to have my favourite story, ran the country for 15 months while he was in England. And he did it by ignoring the cabinet and everything else. Because the complications of getting a telegram coded, posted, decoded and answered became quite excessive. On one occasion in 1918, a telegram cost £100 at a time when a house cost £400. If you wanted to buy the same inner city Melbourne house that I got priced then, that telegram would now cost about $180,000 for one telegram. So he ignored Australia and just announced what the government policy was. These days, of course, you're in contact the whole time. Even in 1981, there was no internet, no mobile phones, no email, and no Twitter. I don't know how the politician survived. Well, I do, because I know on one occasion there was an attempt to find out where Doug Anthony was because there was a crisis, and he was on holiday somewhere on the south coast. So they had to calculate, well, it's about this time of day. That's his favorite restaurant. We'll send the local police around to see if they can contact him at the local restaurant. And he was there. He got quite angry. Are you following me, he said? Are you suspicious that I'm doing something wrong? But here was an effort to say, we need the Deputy Prime Minister reasonably fast, so we have to guess where he might be. Now, of course, he's as far away as a mobile phone, even if it's 3 o'clock in the morning. So officials and governments now can contact people much quicker than they could, and they can be found 24 hours a day, all day, every day, and the technology wants an immediate answer. And that creates pressures which just didn't exist. I was doing a radio program in Queensland on the book that we brought out, Learning to Be a Minister, and it was on a holiday, show day. I don't know if anyone else has them, but Queensland still has show days. And in the middle of this, somebody rang up to say a piece of the desalination plant had broken loose and had run up on the shore. And the radio sort of host said, okay, we'll ring up the minister's office to find out what's happening. And as she put it down, I said, you're proving my point about our expectations of ministers. She probably doesn't even know it's there, little, and it's come loose, and you want an answer from her now. It's unreasonable, but we do it. The media allows us to do it. The media allows us to make the contacts. So the speed of technology happens so much faster. And the consequence and effect has been ministerial staff. Partly the geography of ministerial, the new Parliament House, of course, allows more staff to be appointed. Those of you who can remember the old rabbit warren of the old Parliament House and the places in which politicians and ministers worked will understand how suddenly spacious rooms and offices allow you to abhor the vacuum and fill it with staff. One friend of mine became an MP and said he thought his room looked like a broom cupboard. Then he met the cleaner who complained that since he had been installed, she had to store the broom somewhere else. It had been the broom cupboard. Now, of course, everyone has really nice offices in which they can work. We need staff for personal support, to assist in the management of the political agenda, to assist with the communications, and to maintain a network across governments, across ministerial offices. And, of course, the ministers' offices are now isolated from the backbenchers and the senators in their own ministerial wing. The old notion of the old Parliament House, which if you sat in the King's Hall leaning on the Magna Carta, eventually everyone would walk past and you could talk to them. Nowadays, there is no spot where that can actually happen. One of the effects of ministerial staff that all advice is now contested. That in the old days, ministers had a principal advisor, which was the secretary. Now you have a whole group of people, many of whom are experts, all of whom are on call, and most of them are in the next door office. And departments have found that life has become much more contested than it used to be in the past. Whether it's desirable or not is now irrelevant. It's now there and it's going to happen. And many civil servants, in fact, think it's really useful because they, as one said, apply a different filter than we do, and that's entirely appropriate. We're not ignorant of political considerations, nor should we be, but we don't apply the same political lens to issue that a minister's office can do. We work hard to make sure we work effectively with ministers' offices, and we've generally, I think, been blessed that we don't have advisers who think they're the minister. I suspect there are problems when the advisers forget the nature of their role and try to be something else, to decide matters, to make judgments, to berate people. I've heard examples. Fortunately, I actually haven't had them at the moment. Now, is the minister's job doable? Well, I'm talking recently about Chinese government, and somebody said that really they weren't particularly important. Their department was comparatively small. It only had 6 million people in it. I don't think we've got particularly big departments. So do we ask too much of our ministers? Well, I don't want to be sympathetic. They want the job. They compete for the job. They fight desperately to hold on to the job, even those of them who aren't up to it. Is it too much for one person? No. Not if they know what they're doing and they focus their efforts. Listen to one person on enough rope talking about a far harder political job than anyone in Australia has had, Andrew Denton, is the job too much for one man? Bill Clinton, no. And you could do it, you know. I worked at it harder and longer hours than a lot of people do. I made a decision to work in that way. I've always been almost a workaholic. But the presidency, in the end, is a deciding job. You pay the president to make choices that you, the voter, can't make on your own. So while it's important to work like crazy, it's also important not to become so exhausted that your judgment is impaired. And that was a constant balancing act. I wanted to be working right up to the end, but I didn't want to have impaired judgment. It's a deciding job. It's not that ministers necessarily do some things and other and public servants do others, but when it comes down to the final decision, if there's a difference of opinion, it's the minister as the elected person who decides. Now, we try to categorize ministers. It's always fun. It allows other people to put them in categories. And it also tries to illustrate that you can have different ministers of different sorts who learn how to do the job somewhat differently. We came up with five. The first, what we call the maintenance ministers. Those who have few ideas and few initiatives. They rely on the department to come up with solutions and will have few ambitions but survival. Now, for public servants, contrary to legend, such a captive minister may actually be a nightmare because nothing actually happens. Progress requires ministerial input and an ability to persuade colleagues in Parliament. Ministers who passively accept what they're given by the department will passively accept what colleagues do to them. One minister I was talking to in a coalition government said that when, and he named the minister, but I won't, whenever he brought something to cabinet, we rubbed our hands and thought, ah, now for a bit of sport. You know, cabinet was knocking him off, making him make a fool, and for some of them, that was sport. He said, you know how boring meetings are. We have to entertain it some way. So those are the maintenance ministers. The second are the spruiker ministers, the ones who have no ideas or policy, but can energetically run with the suggestions from the department. Almost all ministers are spruikers at some time. They can't initiate everything. A few never do much more. But their political skill is to present themselves as full of ideas as they sell their new policies to cabinet or the parliament. But it depends on the ability of the officials to develop the ideas which they can then espouse with vigour. Some departments are better at protecting their ministers than others. They need help, but they manage to present themselves. A third are the policy drivers. They know that all the ideas don't come from them. They know they can depend on officials, but they want to list the number of items where they've made their mark by taking crucial decisions and selling them to the government. Often, the policy drivers are not the best-known ministers. They're not the most publicly analysed ministers, but they're the ones who perhaps leave quite a heritage behind them. The fourth are the warriors, the people who like a fight, the people who pick issues which know will get attention and often violent opposition. The battle is the thing, a contest over values and political turf on the grounds there's no point in being a minister if you don't change things big, and if big changes invariably bring big opposition. They enjoy the fight and they want to make substantial changes in government. And the fifth are the partisans. The ones for whom it's all about the political fight. The ones for whom the actual portfolio is comparatively unimportant as long as they can ensure that the party and the government is nicely set up for the previous, for the next election and the next campaign. Sometimes they're given minor portfolios because they're effectively the minister for politics, the minister for getting things right. Five types of ministers, and I'm not arguing that we need all of one or all of the other. I'm just suggesting that the categories give you some idea of the range of ministers that we have and the sort of functions which they fulfil. And on the whole, I suspect the Prime Minister's like a few warriors, but really don't want 18 or 30 warriors in the Cabinet, or life would get far too exciting. They need some quiet achievers as well as the people they can put up front. We know who the warriors are. They're the ones who are constantly appearing on television programmes, the ones that the government or the opposition want to promote. What can we learn, then, from about the way that ministers operate for our system? And let me conclude with four or five comments. Firstly, despite all the rhetoric, this is still a Westminster system. It's still a system based on departments, and as the Secretary said, it's as far from the US system as it's ever been. Don't let people tell you it drifted into a Westminster system. It's Westminster with Australian characteristics. It's different from Canada, it's different from the UK, it's different from New Zealand, it's ours, but it's determined by Parliament House and by all those different parties. Prime Ministers certainly have much greater technological capacity to direct, but ministers remain a key part, and no Prime Minister has ever become quite as demanding, centralising, egotistical and internal self-driven as Billy Hughes. So if you want to do history, there is no trend on Prime Ministers suddenly trying to get more power. They've got the technology that allows them to do it, but they've never, haven't necessarily been more ambitious to control. Second, our expectations of ministers are heroic. We expect ministers to fix everything. Electors want people to increase spending on themselves and lower taxes. If they get into trouble through tempest or intemperance in the suburbs or overseas, they expect ministers to get them out of it. Alexander Downer said when he left office what he couldn't have said when he was in office. When Australian citizens ignore foreign affairs advice and went to the Lebanon and then demanded that the Australians rescue them when war broke out and complained the response was too slow, they were acting unreasonably. They had the warning they should not expect immediate action from government. When people want all the other things which they say governments will do, they will be disappointed. They expect to be consulted at length and have rapid government response. The definition of successful consultation is the government doing what we want it to do. Otherwise, consultation has been inadequate. Government, to misquote President Reagan, is both the problem and the solution. And ministers are their personification, and once a source of relief and the epitome of grubby self-interest. Third, we exaggerate the capacity of governments, perhaps encouraged by the claim for credit for ministers when things go well and for denial when things go badly. Fourth, we have to get away from what I call ministerial narcissism. The notion that ministers are the source of all good ideas and they themselves are the only ones who have affected any sort of change. The concept that they're instigators of all new policies. It's a myth which contributes to their overwork and often makes it difficult to get the key parts of their job well done. We still hear from ministers, particularly ex-treasurers, announcing how I introduced schemes which made our banking system responsible, how I introduced schemes which guaranteed energy, how I did this, as though they were operating alone. They are never operating alone. And that creates, I think, unreasonable expectations and a rather ridiculous notion of independence of ministers which simply doesn't exist. What ministers must do is ensure they contribute where they can and understand those points where their decision is essential. What makes them unique is not a separation of powers, but the right to decide. Fifth, there are still some things that only ministers can do. Only ministers can present a proposal to cabinet. Only ministers can introduce legislation and answer questions in parliament. These are the areas they must perform, because in our system of government, they're essential. In a real sense, this is where they add value to the work that others do. So the best ministers are shrewd, hard-working and intelligent, with common sense and good judgment, but they must work through routines. Routines by which many small decisions and discussions make big things possible. Routines make the chaotic manageable. Routines break the impossible dilemmas into intelligible units for decision. Routines tame the excessive demands into a timetable that, although inevitably hectic, can best allow ministers and their advisers to set priorities and make decisions. Those priorities may not be obvious, and they may not be those that outsiders will accept, and they will differ from minister to minister. But they're the choices that ministers must make in charge of their own time and seeking to sense some sense of direction. We do have some effective ministers who do decide the areas where they want to have an input. They do decide how to ration their time and who they will trust and where they will insist and where they will become involved. They have many people working for them, but our system requires that in the end, ministers must add their own value in the appropriate places to make our system work well. So there's no one way to be an effective minister. But let me quote one minister. Running government is a relentless business. And you could wake up every morning and let it run you and not achieve what you set out to do. Or you can wake up every morning and say, I'm going to run it. I got into this business to achieve the following, and I'm going to crash through, or I'm going to push, and I'm going to achieve them. Lots of things about our system, the shortness of news cycles, the cynicism about politics, the bigness of the bureaucracy, those things conspire to defeat that. You've just got to have the wherewithal each day and every day to say, no, I'm running it, it's not running me. It's a great aspiration that some ministers manage to achieve. It never has been, and it never will be easy, and it's far too much to expect that they will all live up to it. But at least it suggests there's a job there that they can and do, even if it takes time to learn in the first stages. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Weller. Yes, yes. You've demonstrated why I think your new book should be a absolute essential reading for anyone in the ministerial wing and those aspiring to it. Very sage insights indeed. We've got some time for questions. Anyone who would like to ask a question, please go to the microphone at either side and so that we can hear you. Now, you always get first go, so we'll give someone else first go this time. So, gentleman in the blue.
Hello there. Thanks for a very important talk to me. I wanted to ask about science and scientists, whether or not you have any strong feelings or insights into the apparent lack of representation of scientists and science in ministerial portfolios in Australia or any other country you might comment on? And because you alluded to technology, that's why.
The question for ministers is not to be the subject experts, to understand the subject enough to make sensible decisions. I mean, so we don't need a doctor as Minister for Health necessarily. In fact, the one time we had a doctor as Minister for Health, he proved to be comparatively ineffective because he wanted to answer all the medical questions himself. What we need is a health minister who understands the issues, who can answer the questions, and can make judgments about where the country should go. The reason we have a chief scientist, which was set up, I think, about 20 years ago, was so that you could bring together the knowledge of science and present it to government in a way which was intelligible and persuasive. And they like to, the words they like to use these days is evidence-based. So does it matter if we don't have scientists as ministers? Not necessarily. Does it matter if we have ministers who have no advisors who'd explain to them the implications of science on which they can make judgment? Yes, it does. So I think what we need is the skill in collecting advisors to governments on these issues, whether on staff or in departments, on which they can make judgments. It's always interesting where people think they are, don't have to be expert, and where they do have to be expert. Everyone knows economics in cabinet, but they listen to lawyers when they talk about the law. So it varies a bit from place to place. Is there an easy solution? No, there isn't. Would it help if you got a scientist? No, it wouldn't, because not necessarily scientists are not necessarily great politicians. You also have to persuade. And that's not just evidence, that's the sort of information and the way that you do the persuasion as well. I'm not sure that answers your question. I'm never sure that scientists would ever be satisfied they get their voice heard, but then always the question is which scientists, you know.
Question on the left.
My question comes under the heading of matters of public importance. There is a learning curve for those who listen. And on Tuesday, I listened to the Treasurer Swan, and in the middle of his budget debate, he mentioned the word suicide. Now, I sat down to put all the points there, and I decided I'd only ask one point, and then my question. In Japan, they have 30,000 suicides. I'm not going to cover all the rest of Australia, but I'm saying this is a Senate question and it's a House of Representatives question. What should Australians do about that question of suicides in Australia?
I think, suspect it comes under several different titles, one of which is mental health, one of which is support for the people suffering from depression, and those are areas in which have become obviously high profile in the last couple of years. In that sense, of course, governments can do lots of things, but governments can't do everything. So the governments can try and create the environment, the support, and the medical counselling that might be necessary. And at one stage, I think that's what they can do. I mean, governments are inevitably faced by individual choices which they cannot solve. So we can go a lot further than we go. But quite how, I leave to the scientists and the doctors about giving advice, and then it becomes a priorities choice for the government.
Gentleman on the left.
Thank you, Professor. On collective responsibility and collective solidarity, as you know, many other parliamentary systems have much more ministerial autonomy. The ministers can make individual decisions. There's not much a prime minister or finance minister or central minister can do about it. We have a fairly cohesive system where ministers are part of a political team, whether they like their colleagues or not. What did your ministers say in relation to their attitude to that collective solidarity and whether they were prepared to take decisions themselves? Is it different than 81 now? Are they more intimidated by that collective or not? And I think it's two dimensions. One, the jurisdictional dimension with their colleagues federally, but also their interstate ministers through ministerial councils and the like, where they can have a space for autonomy.
I think there's an understanding that things are much less comfortably organised in silos than they used to be. I mean, we used to have a situation in which a health department or other department, on only occasions dealing with finance, dealt with other departments. Now things have become infinitely more complex and cross-portfolio. So that's one of the first changes, I think. It's simply become a more complex world. The second thing is, I think, that the media speed has made life infinitely more difficult than the past. The ease with which you can pick off one minister and ask for an opinion on a topic and then another minister makes them incredibly conscious that the story will be, you know, Minister X disagrees with the Prime Minister or Ministers X have disagreed on that. So the pressure of the media, I think, has made people more cautious in making independent decisions. The third point is that back in 1981, a senior minister said to me, there are a lot of ministers who claim they like to make decisions but actually bring them to cabinet because they just like that collective support. They like to know that once they brought something to cabinet, everyone is committed to it and they can't be hung out to dry if it actually goes wrong in those sorts of circumstances. So I wouldn't underestimate the push for collective responsibility in 1981, which I think was extraordinarily strong then. Why do we have it more than in other countries? New Zealand is less so because New Zealand's now a coalition government. Britain traditionally had powerful ministers before they had that powerful prime ministers. The Australian version has been different. We've had prime ministers that have been powerful since 1901 or 1905 when Alfred Deakin said that he didn't want anyone to make a press statement until they cleared it with him. Nothing new about centralisation and prime ministers in Australia. So there's always been that sense of maintaining some sort of control over the sorts of things that are happening.
Sir?
In a recent speech, Mike Smith, Chief Officer of the ANZ BAC, suggested that the heads of organisations such as his should change every 5 years or so. I was wondering whether you thought this should be the same with ministers, especially if one is to train a minister, one actually has to have a position as a minister to be trained into.
Well, of course, Mike Smith's in the comfortable position to knowing that the bank has probably got most of the people who might be promoted already in it, and they're not going to be tossed out in the next 2 or 3 years by an electorate. The shareholders may throw out the directors, but they don't actually throw out all the staff. So he's got a much longer time horizon and a different sort of accountability. I would be horrified if we actually gave... I think the American notion of time limits has problems. And the problems it has is that after a period of time, if you put a five-year time limit on ministers, after 5 years, all the ministers would have to go if they got elected. And I think the notion of experience is actually quite important. I mean, what you actually have, of course, of a period of a government the last 10 years is massive actual turnover. There are only three ministers in the Howard government who stayed in cabinet for the duration of that Howard government, and that was Howard, Costello and Downer. So if you actually look at the 1996 government that's sworn in and the cabinet ministers, there are only three people who actually stayed there for 10 years. So there actually is often quite considerable turnover. And prime ministers are always looking at a way of turning them over in order to freshen it up, get responsibility, move people out. And they have the advantage they can make them ambassadors to the UN. Now, of course, the other job is that about the prime minister themselves. And it's an interesting fact that one prime minister since 1903 has moved on at a time of their own choice. Only one. Prime ministers are remarkably bad at knowing when the time has come to move on. Usually, of course, someone else moves them on. But invariably, they stay on for a lot longer than their colleagues would think. And therefore, the question for prime ministers is, why stay so long? Because they become convinced, I think, that they are the ones best capable of maintaining this government in power. And we've seen that happening on a number of occasions over the last 40 years. So, and of course, when Menzies retired, he had been there for, 15, 16 years, so that he'd had a fair run, and he was 70. Churchill, of course, was 80 when he retired. So, age doesn't necessarily matter. But ministers, I don't think we need it. I think there's enough turnover already. Prime ministers, interesting question, but don't ask the prime minister.
We've got time for a couple of last quick ones on this side now.
Hello. Thank you for your presentation. I just thought I'd take the opportunity to respond to the earlier questioner who was concerned about suicide and then follow up with my own question. I was fortunate to attend an event 2 evenings ago in this room, which was about how such a large portion of the budget did go to mental illness matters. And I would suggest that people who are interested go to the GetUp website, because that event was organised by GetUp, to see a wonderful little AV they prepared to explain how they got that funding. And it began with the word suicide. So I understand that that funding is aimed particularly at youth suicide and regional suicide. Okay, my question is more specific, and I wondered if you might share with us your thoughts on what seems to be happening between the Minister for Defence and the Department of Defence at the moment.
In 1951, there was a long argument in Cabinet about the inability of the Ministry of Defence to build the planes that when it came to wartime they were prepared to use. There was complaints in Cabinet about the inability of the Department of Defence to bring anything on time. And when at one suggestion it was proposed in talking about troops in Korea to bring in the Chiefs of Staff, Menzies' comment was, oh, don't waste our time with them. They keep telling us why we can't do anything until we tell them to do something and then they go and do it. My point simply of the history is to say there isn't anything particularly new about the tensions which exist between the Defence Department and the Minister. And I think there are a range of, on the one hand, reasons for this in professional terms. But I think we should look at the other side and say that, and when it comes to it, it's the defence troops that are in Afghanistan, It's the defence troops which are in the boats, on the defence, patrolling Australia. It's the defence troops who are doing things which, whether or not they regard it as necessary or desirable, are still fulfilling the government obligations. So they often actually grumble. Sometimes I think they are too keen to please in terms of doing things which then become quite almost impossible to achieve given the demands of the government. So there's nothing much unusual about the tensions between the Defence Department and its culture, the Defence Forces and its cultures, and ministers who may or may not actually appreciate them. So there's nothing very new there. And I'll finally have a statement of interest. I have two sons in the Defence Forces, so I might be biased.
Our last question over here.
I'm interested in your thoughts on the creation of portfolios seemingly to suit individuals to be the ministers, with probably the current example being having one minister for childcare, a separate minister for early childhood, who's also the minister for schools and a separate minister for education, and problems of the crossover.
And a separate minister for tertiary education. There are two or three ways you can organise portfolios. You can do them by function, you can do them by geography, or you can do them on a case of cabinet representation. And at different times, Australia and other countries have done all three. The point of the 1987 reorganisations introduced by Hawke and Mike Codd, principally by Mike Codd, was to try and get a level of logic into it and try and bring a level of continuity so that you combine things, combine functions into comparatively small departments, so that they, comparatively small number of departments, so they can have trade-offs between them. And that worked for something like 5 or 10 years, but it's becoming much more fragmented. The problem with organising around the ministry is, of course, public servants end up in and out of different departments, and that requires more and more cross-departmental negotiation, which often becomes, my comment about silos earlier, becomes time-consuming and obviously not very efficient. I mean, if I was given a preference, and having written at various times on machinery of government, I would be all in favour of saying set a number of departments, make it extremely difficult to move them, and then make people work within them. The government legitimate response would be departments represent our values and represent our directions. You know, they represent a new initiative that we want to have, so we're going to have a Department of Climate Change, and we couldn't have that before because no one thought it was important, but now we do, and that's symbolic of what we're trying to do. So there's no simple answer to what is a suitable set of machinery of governments, and prime ministers in making choices will look at administrative, political, symbolic functions all the time. One could, of course, comment the United States has fewer departments and they change very little, so that's not impossible either.
Okay, well, sadly, our time is up, so I'd like you to join me in thanking Professor Weller for a fantastic lecture, and also to you for great questions.